Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Tuesday, the 10th of August already. Our guest this hour is the author of a fascinating book, The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents, and Indeed They Were. It's a memoir from Dr. Connie Mariano. She became the first military woman in American history to be appointed White House physician in 1992. She was nominated by the Navy and selected by the White House for this position. And in 1994, she was named director of the White House Medical Unit. You will be amazed when you hear about all that encompasses. She was chosen by President Bill Clinton to serve as his personal physician. She served 9 years at the White House, where she was physician to three sitting American presidents, and she completed 24 years of active duty service, retiring from the Navy in June of 2001 with the rank of Rear Admiral. She became the first Filipino American in history to become a Navy Admiral on July 1st, that is, the year 2000. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Mariano. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, that would be okay. That's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. Connie Mariano, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Woo, what a job, what a job.
Oh my gosh,
you must have been exhausted when it was over. I start with this story because I found it so interesting, and we could tease by saying when President Bush asked if you were going to sleep with him, it's the story on the plane, and there weren't enough beds. You had three presidents, really. You were in charge of their health.
Absolutely. In fact, that's the way the story begins. I begin, the very first line of the book is, I never slept with the president. I slept with the former president. In fact, I slept with three all at once on Air Force One.
And you did.
And so as you're raising your eyebrows, my gosh, what's going on? I explain the story that King Hussein of Jordan had died. And as we say at the White House, you die, we fly. We fly out to see. We see you. And Bill Clinton was the president in office, and we had former presidents Ford, Carter, and Bush Sr. on board with us on Air Force One. I had gotten on the plane, was getting on board. I had arrived with President and First Lady on Marine One, and the flight attendant, the chief flight attendant, approached me and was so excited and said, oh, we've got the former presidents. And I said, well, where are they sleeping? He says, well, you know, they're all in the senior staff area. I said, well, yeah, but you don't have any beds there. I mean, the only beds on this plane are the president and first lady and the two fold-out racks in the medical compartment beside the president's suite. And the flight attendant goes, well, you know, I've got sleeping bags for them. And I just was aghast.
Sleeping bags for the presidents.
Right. This cannot be like the presidential slumber party. You must invite them to the medical space. We will use our two fold-out racks and one of our executive-style chairs in which one of them can sleep. And so my nurse and I prepared the room. We each had we put mints on the pillows, of course. We had the place cards with the presidential seal, and each three of them had Mr. President, because that's their name. And they each came in one by one into our medical space.
And Jimmy Carter chose the lower bunk.
He did. He was the first to enter, and he was Navy, former Navy, and he says, permission to come aboard, and I said, I, because he knew I was Navy.
Right.
And he chose the lower rack, and he sat on the edge of the rack and smiled and said, this is just like on board a submarine, because he had been a submarine officer. And then he went to sleep, and the next one to come in was former President Ford, and he was a tall, tall gentleman, and he didn't want any of the racks. There was only one remaining rack above President Carter, and then there were the three executive-style chairs. And he says, I'll take the executive chair. I can lean back in that chair. It's like a recliner. So he went to sleep. And then the final president who entered the space was my first patient, the first of my first patients, George Herbert Walker Bush, who I had served in his last year of presidency. And he came in, and he was winking and rather flirtatious, and he says, may I sleep with you, Connie? And I said, I serve at the pleasure of the president. Mr. President. And then I looked down at his slippers. He had these bedroom slippers, because it's very casual on the plane when you're you know, it's evening and everyone's in their pajamas. And he had these bedroom slippers that had the presidential seal.
Oh.
And I said, oh, wow, those are really nice. And he said, oh, don't give me a hard time. Those jokers, and he points to the other presidents, were giving me a hard time about that. And he was kidding. And I said, well, we have only one rack available. It's the one on top. He says, all right, I'll do it. And I said, do you need any help? He says, I can do this myself. So he climbed over Jimmy Carter, and he got above on the top rack, and then we dimmed the lights. And I looked over at my nurse, who is African-American, a male African-American nurse, and I thought this was quite interesting, this scenario. It's only in America, of course. And so as we dimmed the lights, you know, I said goodnight to all, and it was very eerie because, you know, there's a sort of a glow in the lights in the compartment. We were flying, and Bill Clinton at one point poked his head inside the suite and looked around, and he sort of smiled and waved. And I, at one point, you know, you can't really sleep because I was thinking of all the things that were going on this trip. And at one point, my nurse had dozed off. He woke up with a start, and he looked at me, and I said, that's okay. Just look around you. You know, it sort of hit him who was in our compartment. I said, just make sure they all keep on breathing.
Yes. And that must have been at the back of your mind, Dr. Mariano. That's a huge responsibility. You're responsible. And you had some amazing experiences all over the world. But to have all of these presidents right there with you.
You know, you pinch yourself, but you have to realize, as any good military officer, it's all about the mission. You're there to support them and make sure they stay alive and do your job. And a lot of my friends used to think, oh, what a glamorous job. You fly around with the president, and you're always, you know, dressed up in these nice clothes. I said, no, you have no idea. And hopefully the book will,
yes,
will clear that up, that it is not always glamorous appearing, that it's long hours, it's exciting yet exhausting, and you could get killed in the process. So you have to sort of be careful in this job.
Right. You could get killed in the process. That says, well, you have to be so intelligent to do this and caring, but you have to take some risks as well. Tell me about your getting this. You didn't even know that there was such a job as White House physician, right? You were recommended for this job not knowing much about it.
Absolutely. I never knew this job existed. I had been in the Navy about 10 or 11 years. I was at the Naval Hospital in San Diego in the 1990s, and at that time, I was coming up to the end of my commitment. I had gone to the military medical school, and part of that scholarship was you pay back so many years. Well, it was coming to the end of my payback time, and I was trying to think, what do I do? Well, San Diego's hometown for us, and my husband at the time was an attorney working in San Diego. We had a house three doors down from my parents, so our kids were, you know, had people to look out for them. And I was at the point, I was on the wards all the time. It was in the middle of the Gulf War. I didn't deploy. I was in the hospital, and it was long hours, and then it was just, it wasn't what I had envisioned military medicine to be, and I thought, well, what do I do? Do I get out? Do I stay in? And it was one at the point where I thought, I think I'm going to get out. I had the papers for release for active duty on my desk, literally on my desk. I was going over them, realized, my gosh, it's like you're divorcing the military, which had been my whole life as a Navy brat. And while those papers sat on my desk, the chief of medicine called me, and he didn't know I was thinking about getting out. And he called me and said, listen, I just got the message traffic from Washington, and there's an assignment open. It's the assignment of the Navy White House physician, because Army, Navy, and Air Force each has one physician at that time that represents them, and they take care of the president, the vice president, their families. They travel with them. And he says, I want to nominate you among the six people from the Navy. And I said, well, I've never heard of that job. And he told me the names of the people who had previously had that job. And he said, well, he named the names, and I was surprised. I said, well, they're all men. He says, well, doesn't, and my boss, being a wise boss, says, well, that's all right, has no problem, we have no problems with you being a woman. And then I called my husband. I said, let me ask my husband, who was an attorney in the town, and I called him, and I ran this by him. He says, oh, no way. He says, you're crazy. He said, you know, first of all, you're a woman, you're not going to get it. And plus, you know, we lived in Washington, it's hot, it's humid, and they don't have good Mexican food like they do here, and, you know, all the reasons. And I said, you're right. He says, you'll never get it. There's no way. And I said, you're right. Let me tell them, forget it. So I was ready to call back the chairman of medicine when my husband called me back. And he said, wait a minute. On second thought, you have nothing to lose. You'll get a nice visit to the White House. You get interviewed, meet a lot of people.
Sure.
And it'll be a great resume item in case you work for an HMO. And I said, you know, that's it. So I went into the interview as the person who would least likely get the job.
And yet, proving that interviews can make a huge difference. You weren't sure what you were going to say, and then you said these profound words, and you were hired on the spot.
It was an amazing interview. First of all, in the days before Google, I had researched who was going to interview me. And the man
Wise
who
move.
Made the final decision was J. Burton Lee III, who was George Herbert Walker Bush's senior physician. He was the presidential physician and the head of the medical unit. He was politically appointed, and he had been friends of the Bush family for many years. And he was the final say. And I had read interviews where he was sort of old school, you know, the type who thought men became doctors and women became nurses, and sort of an Ivy League country club type of guy. And I thought, I have nothing in common with him. He's just not going to figure where I fit here. And so I went to the interview, and there are several parts. You meet with the White House security folks, and they make sure there's no problem to get your top secret clearance. They said it was fine. I met with the other White House doctors, the Navy, the incumbent Navy, the Army and the Air Force doctors, and they were said, great, this is wonderful. And the final interview was Dr. Lee. He brought me into his office. Actually, Dr. Roberts, who's the incumbent, brought me into Dr. Lee's office, which is on the ground floor of the White House. And I sat waiting to be interviewed first, and Dr. Roberts went to the door, and he announced to Dr. Lee, who's on the other side of the door, I have the next candidate here among the six. And all I could hear from the other side was, well, did you bring her paperwork? This very gruff voice. Did you bring her papers? And Dr. Roberts realized, oh, my gosh, I left them at the other building, in the executive office building across the way. And I heard something thrown across the room as though there were files or papers thrown across the room. And I heard this gruff voice of, well, never mind. I can make the decision without it. And I thought, oh, my gosh, he's already upset. So Dr. Roberts backed away from the door. He looks at me and says, you're on. And so I took a deep breath, and I said a silent prayer. I said, if this is meant to be, show me a sign. And I went into the room. I stepped in, and there was Dr. Lee, 6'1", in his mid-60s, very distinguished. And I saw the sign, and it made me smile, because the sign was a single Band-Aid across his forehead. And at that time, my children were 3 and 5, so I was a mommy. And I looked at the Band-Aid and thought, in a mommy way, oh, he's got a boo-boo. He's got a boo-boo on his forehead. And I thought, don't worry. And so we sat down, and the first thing out of his mouth was, why do you want this job? And I, you know what, at this point, I thought, I have nothing to lose. And the words that came out of my mouth were, Dr. Lee, it's payback time. And he looked at me like, what? Like, I'm not expecting this. And I said, it's payback time. I owe a lot to the United States of America. My father was a poor man when he joined the U.S. Navy in the 1940s. He brought us to this country. We went to school here. I went to the military medical school on a scholarship. I joined the U.S. Navy as a result of that. I've had so many opportunities to learn and to be advanced in this country. And so I owe a lot to America. And if I can pay back that debt by serving as a physician to the commander-in-chief, that's what I'd like to do. And so there's dead silence. There's no expression on Dr. Lee's face. And I'm thinking, oh, this is not going anywhere. The next question comes. He goes, what can you do here? And I said, well, Dr. Lee, you look at these stripes on my sleeve. I have 3 gold stripes. I'm a commander in the Navy. The longer I'm in the Navy, the more stripes they put on my sleeve, the more they shove me behind a desk. And I pointed to his desk. I'm not a desk doctor. I'm a trench doctor. I can take care of patients anywhere in the world. You put me anywhere, any place, I can take care of them. I know how to do that. And again, dead silent, no expression. He's just staring at me. And I'm thinking, this is not going. I mean, I have no reaction from this guy. And then what seemed like forever, maybe 3 minutes pass, he's looking at me, staring at me. He stands up abruptly. And so I decide I have to stand up too. And he says, as far as I'm concerned, we can stop the process right now. And I thought, oh, no, he's going to throw me out. I'm done. He says, I don't care who we're interviewing today or tomorrow. You've got the job. And then he smiled, the only time he smiled, and says, I'm going to go tell Barbara Bush. So he walked out of the room. I followed him out. He walked past his reception room where I was standing, across the hallway, up the elevator to the second floor to Mrs. Bush. And I stood there in his wake, and I looked at Dr. Roberts, who was waiting there, and the secretary who was sitting there, and they were quizzical. They said, wow, that was really fast. What happened? And I said, I think I got the job. That was it.
That's a wonderful, wonderful story. And a couple of things come immediately to mind. Little did you know how a Band-Aid was also going to play an important role, and perhaps you kept a job. What is it with Band-Aids? So go ahead to the story when you're – and who even thinks of this, that the physician is following around the presidents while they're playing golf, but there you are.
Oh, yes. And you're actually Velcro to the president. Wherever he is, you are. Because if he gets sick,
yes,
has a heart attack, a stroke, or if somebody shoots him, a bomb goes off, you have to be as the first responder
there. You're right there.
So here it is, you know, President George Herbert Walker Bush is playing golf in Frederick, Maryland. You know, typical golf game, he and his buddies, and about 8 golf carts with Secret Service, mess specialists, White House communications, but we're all dressed trying to fit in. Well, you know, you don't quite fit in when you're all with these Secret Service guys who are muscle men, you know, with their earpieces. So I'm sitting in a golf cart with a military aide who's also in his golf attire, and we're trying to look discreet, and we can see the president, you know, teeing off, and we're not too far away along the golf path, and we're sitting in the golf cart, and between us is the nuclear football, which is a black briefcase, and my medical bag side by side. And I'd been at the White House probably about, the first couple weeks. And at that time, there was really no formal protocol regarding what you pack in your medical bag. I had just received a hand-me-down bag from somebody else in the medical unit, and I was told, just fill it with whatever you think you might need. Well, I thought, well, let's see. In case he has a heart attack, I need to pack this. In case, you know, he's shot, I need to pack this. So I sort of packed it for those type of scenarios. So we get the call that from the agent with President Bush. He needs a Band-Aid. He's got an abrasion behind his ankle from his golf shoe. And I said, oh, no problem. So I start looking through my newly packed bag, and I realize I don't know if I've even packed a Band-Aid. Oh, my gosh, or any type of dressing. As I'm going through there, I'm tossing out the intubation kit, the cardiac medications, the nitroglycerin, all this stuff. And I thought, oh, my gosh. So as I'm going through this one by one, President Bush is walking towards the golf cart closer and closer. And the military aide is like, is there a problem? I said, I think so. And I'm rifling through it, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. And as he gets closer and closer, I'm panicking more. I'm throwing things out of the darn bag. And pretty soon he comes up to the cart, and he's getting ready to put his foot down on the fender. And at the bottom of my bag, as though placed there by divine intervention, is a single crumpled Band-Aid. And I said, hallelujah. Oh, my gosh.
Story.
Somebody put it there. And so I reached down. I grabbed the Band-Aid. I go to him to his side because now at this point he's already planted his foot, his shoe, onto the fender, and he's pulled down his sock, and you can see the little abrasion on his ankle. And I slap on the Band-Aid, pat it, and he smiles and says, great job. Great job.
And you saved your job.
I saved my job. Oh, no, God saved my job. So then I sat down, and from then on, it was interesting because the mill aide who's smiling at me, he'd been there 2 years, was getting ready to rotate, and actually was sort of cold to me because he was watching me, it's the rites of passage, right? He looks at me and says, I want to tell you one thing. I said, what? He says, at the White House, little things are big things.
Hmm.
And I always remember that.
Yeah.
And so from then on, I always carried lots of Band-Aids.
Our guest this hour is Dr. Connie Mariano. Her book is The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents, a memoir. We're welcoming your phone calls. She has many more stories to tell. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. She was the personal physician for President Bill Clinton, and she served President Herbert Walker Bush. She was director of the White House Medical Unit. Most of the years were with Clinton, but of course she's had, as you heard her start the show, experiences with many of the former presidents. So join our conversation if you'd like. We'd like to hear from you, and I'm sure she would as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome phone calls for Dr. Connie Mariano, 800-486-8655. Rick in Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hello. I would like to ask your guest about numerous reports in the press. The that there was rampant recreational drug abuse in the Clinton administration, in the White House, and in particular that on some occasions couriers actually came to the White House with hypodermic needles full of an unknown substance for the president, and whether that could have something to do with Mr. Clinton's present health care problems. Now, if you're a guest...
Where in the world did you hear that, Rick?
Hippocratic oath, I'll understand.
Where did you hear those reports, Rick?
Oh, I used to hear them periodically in the press.
In the press?
Yeah.
No, I was not aware of any hypodermic needles or drugs being delivered. In fact, there's drug screening at the White House. Anybody who gets a clearance, even his staff, has to go through drug screening. And the reason I know that was my office was responsible for following up on anybody who popped positive on a drug screen. So I was not aware of it. You might have heard there was an incident, and I talk about it in my book, regarding an allergy serum, an allergy shot. It was a vial of Bill Clinton's allergy serum that was shipped to us, to the White House, early in his presidency from Little Rock, mm-hmm. from his allergist, Kelsey Kaplinger. And there was a big skirmish about that because Bert Lee, my boss, hung around when Clinton came in office, even though Bert was supposed to leave. And there was the incident about the giving him an allergy shot, and that serum came in the mail. It actually came with a courier, was identified where it came from. We verified it. I called the person who sent it, who's Kelsey Kaplinger, his allergist. So we verified there was a chain of custody regarding that. Well, Bert Lee didn't want to give it because then he started talking about, well, how do you know it's amphetamines? I said, Bert, come on, we know where it came from. We know the doctor.
Right.
We've had it tested. We know what that is. The guy needs his allergy shot because he gets it every week. And so Bert Lee went to the press and said he was fired because he didn't give the president his allergy shot. And actually, it wasn't true. I explained in my book he got fired because he was politically appointed and shouldn't be hanging around the White House when the other side came in. So, no, I wasn't really aware of it. I know other administrations, there were rumors. I know under Kennedy, there was a Dr. Feelgood, I used to call him Feelgood, from New York, who was rumored to come into the White House and administer sort of pituitary extract and amphetamines under Kennedy. And, again, there were rumors there. The doctor who last was aware of that has since died. And so there are rumors about that. But under Clinton, rampant, you know, I wasn't aware of that. And had any of the staff been positive for drug use or anybody, we would have known because we did the drug testing
right.
for them. And actually, we had to follow up whether they needed therapy or, you know, what went on. So that's an interesting story.
You also knew, though, that you had to be careful with this story and careful with Bert. So you, I believe, alerted Dee Dee Myers to this.
We did. We were in a very tenuous position because Bill Clinton had just came into office, and he didn't know us. He didn't know our staff. He didn't know anything about what we were doing there. And here the story was going to break because Bert Lee was going to go to the Washington Post the next morning and say that the new president fired him. And so the senior Army officer at the time, the senior doctor, and I said, listen, we got to do something. So we went to Dee Dee Meyer, who was his press secretary, and she goes, who are you guys? And we explained
right.
her what we did. And then she says, oh, my gosh. She said, my dad was a Navy pilot. I was a Navy brat, you know, so you connect on a human level. And we explained to her, listen, we may have a problem here. This is coming, you know, to the press. And she was very grateful. And so that afternoon when the press started hearing rumblings of, you know, Clinton fires Bush's doctor, she explained what had happened. And I was the one actually who administered the shot. And, you know, in terms of Bill Clinton's current problems or his medical problems after he left office, they were from coronary disease. And if you look at a man in his late 50s, history of high cholesterol, high stress, and some possible family history, he was at risk. And we studied him at Bethesda Naval Hospital every year for his annual physical, and we did stress echocardiogram testing on him. We did everything we did that was appropriate at the time and didn't find any indication. It was after he left office, and one of the theories about his heart disease, like a lot, millions of Americans who get it, is he had a plaque or fatty deposit in his artery, one of the arteries, that ruptured that caused symptoms.
Right.
And I'm grateful that he had symptoms that caused him to ask for help. He didn't have sudden death, which about 10 to 15% of these people do. He had symptoms. He survived it. And actually, at the time this happened, when he had his bypass surgery, I was at Mayo Clinic. in Scottsdale. And a lot of men actually came to see me afterwards and said, I'm really worried because what Bill Clinton described, I've been having that type of chest pain. And so as a result, a lot of people have gotten some help. And a lot of ways, if you look at our presidents and their families, they're sort of a medical model. You look at Betty Ford when she had her breast cancer and her type of mastectomy. A lot of women follow that. It's sort of an effect, you know, if the president goes for his annual exam, he gets a colonoscopy, a lot of people talk about it, and they say, well, gee, you know, I'm the same age, I guess I should be getting that too. So they are a medical example, role model, if you have it, for a lot of our people.
Which is why President Obama should quit smoking.
Oh, definitely. You know, for him as a human being, it's you can cite the health hazards in terms of heart attack, stroke, lung cancer, emphysema, all of those, but also as an example for everybody, you know, for young children, you know, well, you know, if it's cool to smoke, it's present, it's okay to smoke, right? Well, it's not. So, Yeah, it's a huge example.
I was struck, I know you cared for family members as well. I was struck by the time that you spent and the heart-to-heart conversation you had with President Clinton's mother.
His mother, Virginia Kelly, was an amazing woman. She was the type of person, when she walked into the room, it got brighter. She was full of life, energetic, and I can see where he got his charisma. And she made it was almost like her purpose. She'd walk into the room, and she wanted to make sure everybody liked her. And we liked her, especially at the White House Medical Unit, because she was a former nurse anesthetist. And she had, and one of the stories she told me, which was really sad, she said it was, you know, she had a rough time because her husband, her first husband, Bill Clinton's father, biological father, was killed shortly after, after she was, you know, she was pregnant with Bill Clinton, and her husband died. He died in a car accident and never saw his son. And then after she had him, her parents helped raise him, and she had to go on with her career. And she was going to school. I'm trying to remember, was it was in Tulane? She would take the train to go to school, and she remembers going to the train station, waving goodbye, and weeping as she waved goodbye to her parents who were holding her son, because that was so painful for her. But a lot of our time together was when she was dying of her breast cancer. She did not want anybody to know, especially your son, who was just inaugurated, about what was happening. And we had one final Thanksgiving with her. Actually, it was the first Thanksgiving the Clintons had in office at Camp David, and that was her last Thanksgiving with them, where she was very sick, didn't want him to know. She needed a blood transfusion, and so the nurse and I had administered that in her cabin at Camp David. And we spent the afternoon just sitting there telling stories and just enjoying her company.
Yeah, it was a lovely scene. There's also something about you, and I can tell it just in talking to you. I didn't know what the interview would be like. I love the book. But you've got this really genuine, down-to-earth quality about you, which I know has served you well, but you've never forgotten your roots. You had strong friendships with people who were really serving the president in terms of making food and being valets, etc. You're a genuine person, and I'm wondering why that's been important to you, and if people appreciated that about you at the very highest levels, if the presidents appreciated that about you.
I really believe it comes from your roots, and I was very blessed. I did have, you know, I came from adversity. I didn't know we were poor at the time. Nobody told us that. But I was born in another country. My father and mother were both from the Philippines. My father had tremendous poverty and difficulty in his life, and I was always been the underdog. I mean, growing up in the 50s and 60s in America, I first started off in Hawaii. I didn't speak English, learned English sort of from my classmates, went to public school. And then in the 60s, you know, we crossed the country from California to Washington in the days where, you know, things were segregated. And so we didn't know whether, you know, we weren't black, we weren't white, what were we? And so you're always the underdog, you're always sort of the foreigner, always being underestimated. And I think and it's still hard to shake. The mantra growing up is you're never good enough. And it's funny, I see this in a lot of my patients now who are CEOs, who are tremendously successful. and are dealing with issues of being overachievers. And I said, what's your secret? And they said, well, because I always believe I'm never good enough. You're always trying. Also, my family believed in humility, that you don't brag about it. You just do your job. Don't make a big fuss. Don't let it get to your head. And I think that served me well, that at the White House, it really isn't about you. It's about the president. And one of the greatest pieces of advice that Al Roberts, my predecessor, gave me is you approach this job with a servant mentality. And when I used to orient new doctors, one of the things I would tell them over and over again is, when you come to the White House, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience that people will say their pre- and post-White House years. It is that critical that they divide their life before and after the White House in that setting, in those terms. And you either leave here better or bitter.
Hmm.
And the difference between better or bitter is if you come here to give or to take. And it's a huge example. The people I've seen, you know, a lot of the lessons I've learned are what not to do. A lot of the reasons I've done so well is I followed somebody who didn't do so well. So you sort of take advantage of that, and you go with what you can. And I always believe if you in some way have touched people's lives to make them better, then you would have had a good life.
Yes. Tell me about, because I was just astounded, Dr. Mariano, by all the preparations that are put in place for foreign travel, for anticipating the worst in terms of the drills that you had to do, visiting hospitals, testing food sometimes to make sure that it's not poisoned. These are elaborate preparations to keep the president and his family safe. Take the top three, or you've written about many of them in the book. I think the Kenny Bunkport one is one of the more dramatic. The precautions that are taken and the number of people involved in this, such a huge effort.
I always say, I use Hillary Rodham Clinton's terms, it takes a village, and it does. It takes a village to take care of the president. And every, let's say, we call it movement. Whenever the president goes, let's say, he wants to go visit, he's going to do a speech in Washington, D.C., okay? And, he's in the hometown. We advance it. We send one of our representatives to the hotel. They know exactly where he's going to go, what path he will take, where he will walk through. So they look at any places he could trip, slip, fall. They look at where the bathrooms are in case he needs to go. They know what kind of food is being served. So the White House, actually, the military office has the stewards or valets, mess specialists, who go in to see where the food is prepared. In fact, the plate that is given is it's chosen by the White House representative. So it isn't, you know, somebody says, oh, we're going to give this to president. It's selected by somebody else at the White House so it's not tainted.
Oh, my.
And sometimes they will taste the food. Even the food on Air Force One, they go out in plain clothes as plain clothesmen and go grocery shopping. So you don't know where that food comes from. Even as medications, we get it from sources, but it's not his name. We use another name. Because you don't want to say, you don't want people to slip him something that could hurt him.
Right.
But even, let's say we go overseas, we send people in advance. The White House pre-advance is a team of people who go several months in advance of his visit to look at the sites, the venues, the hospitals. And then they do the advance, which is a couple weeks before he arrives there, in which our representative will look at every hospital and designate one or two that we would use. They would look at where he arrives. They would look at the list of doctors they would use. We would bring our own blood overseas in case he needed to be transfused.
My.
There's so many intricate plans, even to the telephone he uses. In fact, we bring a whole network of communications with us. All the helicopters are brought with us on an airplane, or on a separate military airplane. All the cars. We don't use the cars in the country. We ship the cars.
I didn't know that.
C-17.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. Every little detail.
Huh.
So it's flawless. And then on top of that, you worry of all these threats. And then for the medical, just even the medical side, not only of any illness, but any type of trauma, we train with Secret Service every month at Beltsville, where we simulate the president being attacked or injured, and where we, as the medical responder, would be if that happens. And really the other reason that a lot of people don't realize, why do you need a doctor, why do you need a team, is the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, which deals with presidential disability. If the president is incapacitated, who's running the country?
Mm-hmm.
And so our role as the White House doctor, number one, do the appropriate thing medically, but also remind, you know, his political staff, gee, the president's going in for surgery. He's going to be unconscious. You all need reminder, to institute the 25th Amendment. And that's a political action that needs to take place. So
right.
Over and over again, when we used to drill with Secret Service, you do all the ABCDs of trauma, all the right things. But then the final is, what about the 25th Amendment? Because not everybody did that before us. I mean, we remember when Ronald Reagan was shot, you know, who was running the country? And Alexander Haig said he was in charge.
Well, yes, he did. Yeah. Right. So did you have to, did that have to be invoked on many occasions when you were the White House physician?
Under Clinton, no. We never had to invoke it. The only surgery he had...
The knee surgery.
Was his quadriceps leg surgery, and he did not want to. He said, I want... We gave him the option of general anesthesia. He says, no, can you do a spinal? So he got a spinal anesthetic, and I sat at the head of of where he was stood. I sat with him, and while he was having his surgery, he was talking to me and the anesthesiologist, and we were playing country western music. Now, but it did get invoked under the last President Bush when he underwent colonoscopy at Camp David. They had to do a follow-up colonoscopy. They instituted the 25th Amendment, and Dick Cheney carried the duties of office for a couple of hours while President Bush was under anesthesia. So they did, and everything went well.
And the training that you, well, first of all, let's go back to the danger of the job. At least you knew that you had to be in a somewhat safe situation as you were traveling because, for heaven's sake, you were the White House doctor. I mean, you had to stay alive, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, one of the things I tell my docs, you know, don't get in the kill zone. Don't get so close to him that if he's shot, you're, like, right behind him. You could get hit. You want to be close enough but far enough away. And, again, it's true. It's what you allude to. You can't help him if you're dead. So you really have to stay alive.
Right. Dr. Connie Mariano is our guest. Her book is such a highly interesting one, The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents, a memoir. There is a foreword by former President William Clinton in the book, and it's quite a read, as her history is, because she was selected by the White House to be the first military woman in American history to be appointed White House physician. She was named director of the White House Medical Unit and chosen by President Clinton as his personal physician, served 9 years at the White House. Can you imagine the stress of that job? She was physician to 3 sitting American presidents. Here's our phone number. Please join the conversation if you'd like. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now. Carla on Highway 45 is joining us. Hi, Carla.
Hi. I've been listening to all this interesting stuff about all the logistics of when you go someplace else. And the question that I had was... does it work the other way, too? Like, has your guest ever had a chance to work on somebody from elsewhere? And what happens if they want to bring things in that aren't allowed in this country? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks, Carla.
So what was that? If we wanted to do something that wasn't taken in this country? I don't understand.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the second part of it. But have you had the experience of working on somebody as you went to a foreign country from the foreign country? There were times when you in charge of... Well, there's some interesting stories here about you.
We did actually, through the State Department, were called upon to take care of several foreign leaders. That makes it interesting. You know, I've trained in the traditional sense. I do respect alternative forms of medicine because a lot of my patients embrace that as well. But especially when you travel with the president, you pretty much, when you take care of the president, you have to do what's traditional medicine that will hold up as the standard of care. I know at the White House, after I left, they used acupuncture. I don't know if they did that on President Bush, but they have used acupuncture as it's being used more in the military. But on foreign leaders, we offer them whatever was westernized care because that's what they were seeking. But no, I haven't had the opportunity to offer them alternative forms or try alternative forms yet.
Tell us the story of the shot being given in the butt in the bathroom.
It's
pretty funny.
These people were.
I know.
We were at the Summit of Americas in Miami, And Bill Clinton was in meetings all day long, and I had a physician assistant helping me, and I had one of my nurses there as well. And it was it so happened that the president of Guatemala had he had a swollen toe. He had a gout episode, which is very painful. And a member of the State Department came over and said, "Do you mind if you take a look at the president of Guatemala? You know, he doesn't bring any medical staff because a lot of the foreign leaders don't have any, you know, their doctors. They sort of rely upon the host nation." Mm. And so I sent my physician assistant to go see the president of Guatemala. My PA came back and said, "Well, the poor man's got gout, and he really needs something to kill the pain. And we have IV Toradol, which is sort of intravenous. It's an injectable form of Motrin, which could really help, we hoped." And so we had the we had a injectable form with us, and you needed to give it in the buttock, in the muscle, in the gluteus maximus muscle. So we're trying to find where to give this, and here we are at the Summit House, which is a huge building with various meeting rooms. And so my PA had networked with the assistant to the president of Guatemala, and they decided to give it the shot in the men's room. So I'm sitting outside of the men's room on a bench with my nurse because I'm close enough I can see where the president would be in the room. And I'm waiting there, and I see my physician assistant, the president of Guatemala, and his bodyguards go into the men's room. And actually, the bodyguards turned around, and they stood outside while the physician assistant and the president of Guatemala were in the room. And I think, okay, he's getting them the shot. Well, as they're in there, I hear over the radio Eagle, who's Bill Clinton's codename, moving to the bathroom. And I thought, uh-oh, we're going to have a little encounter here. So there I see Bill Clinton. He waves to me, and he's with his agent, Lou Merletti, and they step into the men's room. I'm thinking, And so a few minutes later, I hear this laughter, and then the men are leaving. And then I see Bill Clinton and his agent leave, and then there's President Guatemala limping away with his medical staff, with his agents, and my physician assistant comes out, and he's red in the face. I said, "What happened?" He says, "Well, first of all, I gave the shot, but you would never expect it, because as he was getting ready to administer the shot, you know, he's drawing up the syringe, the president of Guatemala has pulled down his pants to bare his buttock. He's bending over. And at that very moment, Bill Clinton walks in with his agent."
No.
And all Bill Clinton can see in this bathroom in the men's room in Miami is one guy bearing his buttock and another man with a needle.
Oh, my God.
And
gosh.
He looks at the agent and says, he pulls him aside and says, "I think they're doing drugs in here." And his agent says, "Sir, no, no, no. That's,
no,
that's
the man
Ed Luminati. He's the physician assistant for the medical unit." And they're like, well, at this point, the president of Guatemala recognizes Bill Clinton, pulls up his pants, shuffles over, shakes his hand, and they greet each other. And then, you know, they say hello, he gets a shot. So it's, you know, all these human things.
Right.
And where do you try to find a place to be discreet enough to do this?
Yeah, it's quite a story. Brittany in Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm speaking of exposing buttocks. I recall a few months ago that Obama had, you know, when he turned 50, his physical exam, instead of getting the traditional colonoscopy, he got the virtual colonoscopy precisely because he didn't have to be sedated and, you know, use the 25th Amendment. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you know anything about that, but I just thought
I know from what I read in the press reports, he actually just turned 49,
right?
And they did do the virtual, which means you do this. In fact, a lot of my patients ask about it because they don't want to be sedated. They want to go play golf afterwards. And so what they did is you'd still do the prep beforehand, which is clear liquids, and then you do the laxatives to cleanse your bowels. Then they put a little tube in the rectum. They pump you up with air, and they put you to a CT scanner. And exactly, you don't have to be sedated. They can actually visualize if there are any polyps. But then, if they see any polyps, you still need to go through the colonoscopy where they put the tube in. So they put the little proctoscope in, or the colonoscopy scope in, to cut out the polyp. So fortunately, I think they said they didn't find anything. He's good for, say, 5 to 8 years. But I think they do. They weigh that heavily. They said, will it affect the country if I undergo the 25th Amendment? And you know, if it's thought out reasonably, the country is not in the middle of a major crisis, you can do it because you're only out for a couple of hours. But that was his decision, you know, after talking to his doctors, and it worked out well.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. This was hard for you, I know. It's an email from Marie. I might have missed this, but have you talked about your children yet, how you handled this huge job and a family at the same time? It's certainly was not easy.
It was very hard being a White House doctor and being a mom and a wife. And it is exactly what you would expect from military deployed, because I was active duty. I just had a very nicer battlefield than most of my colleagues who were in the Gulf. But you're gone a lot. You spend more time with the first family. You're traveling with them. And so the only times I really saw my children were when they were asleep. You know, they were asleep when I got home late at night, or they were asleep early in the morning when I would leave. They were 3 and 5 when I started that job. They were 12 and 14 when I left. And I missed when they had chicken pox. I missed when my oldest son ran into a tree and needed sutures. And so you have this ongoing guilt. Oh, my gosh, I'm not there for them.
Sure.
I'm not there. And it was a very painful time, because I felt awful about that. But I was torn. I had to do my job. I was on active duty. My husband at the time, we since divorced, which I think definitely the White House job did not help. It actually further showed that we really had a difficult marriage. Really was not happy with me in that job, because I was gone. I wasn't there with him to help raise the children. He was an attorney, and he had to work part-time for a law firm in D.C., and the rest of the time it was Mr. Mom. And in Washington, you know, you go to a cocktail party, they go, what do you do? Well, he didn't like to say, you know, he was a stay-at-home dad. He would just say, he would tell them he was the domestic advisor to the physician to the president.
Oh, that sounds official enough.
We divorced a couple years ago, but it actually worked out. He's since remarried. I've happily remarried a couple of months ago, so life goes on.
Oh, congratulations.
On. Thank you. And our boys are doing well. Our sons are 21 and 23.
Oh, my goodness.
They've grown up. They actually have pretty good memories of what's going on. I see them a lot now. They're very resilient. They're good boys. They've done well.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Tell us the story, because there were, you believe, some politics at play here. You had to live through the Lewinsky episode in the White House, and at one point you were, I believe, ordered to draw the blood of President Clinton for his DNA. Can you talk about that incident?
That was a very painful time. You know, when I had heard about the intern, it was funny, I talk about it in my book, as a doctor, when I hear the words intern, I only know it in the medical context. It's somebody who has enough knowledge to be dangerous in the medical field. That's an intern. So I thought, oh, goodness, what's this going on about Clinton, et cetera? And then before I know it, all my friends are being subpoenaed. And then as they get close to the president, then they want DNA. And I was active duty military. And so the word came from the Independent Counsel's office to Bill Clinton's attorney that they want the DNA and they want the White House doctor, meaning me, to draw it. And I just was disgusted. I said, I don't want any part in this. And they said, you cannot refuse. This is an order. You must do this. And, well, first of all, as a doctor, I don't draw blood all the time. I'm not very good at it. I admit it. I have nurses and medics who draw it very well.
Yes.
People who know how to do that. So I had to practice a little bit. And then it was done on a Saturday at 10 o'clock at night in the map room next to my office. So it wasn't even a doctor's office. It was in the map room. So Bill Clinton came down that evening after an event on the state floor. And he was actually very matter-of-fact. His attorney, Dave Kendall, was there, a representative from Ken Starr's office there, and a woman FBI agent was there. And so I drew the blood, I handed the tube, we signed off chain of custody, and they were on their way.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can talk about them or not, but we have read reports that so many people were let down, that you believed in his innocence, and so many staffers did. And when you heard the news, you were aghast. Can you comment on that?
I didn't want to believe all the things that I heard, and all along thought this is something that his enemies have contrived. And I actually found out, like a lot of Americans, when he confessed from the map room, which was right next door to my office, and when he was doing that taping, that broadcast, I was next door in my office watching it live, and Rahm Emanuel, who's now chief of staff for Obama, was involved with communications for Clinton, came into my office in the middle of it, was watching it with us, and as Bill Clinton is doing his confession, Rahm says out loud, "This is not going well." And he rushes out because it looked like he knew what was going on. He knew what was rehearsed. And I felt sick. I thought, oh, Lord, this is not a good time. And I felt sorry for his family. Mm-hmm. And I felt sorry for all the people who had been subpoenaed.
Sure.
So it was a disappointment. It was a letdown. It was a tremendous letdown, and it took a while to recover from that.
I'm sure it did. We have time for one more phone call. Only 45 seconds left, though. Mike from Oshkosh. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. I'll be real quick.
Okay.
I wonder if the guest could describe the reported tension between the Clinton administration when they first came in and the military that were at the White House. And then secondly, I'm wondering if there's still a tradition at the White House where there's Filipino cooks. I know that had been the case for decades. I wonder if it's still true.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
In the beginning, there was a sense, we had heard rumors, because we were military there, that the Clintons didn't like the military. That was in the beginning. I don't think that was the case. When they came in, they were actually very amazed that we had so many military staff, about 2,000 of us. And I think as they got to know us and appreciate us, they really liked the military. We were very squared away, as they say it. And as the tradition of Filipino cooks, I think for years there had been Filipino chefs. I think that number is diminishing. But that has been a tradition. In a lot of ways, it points back to my whole book, which is an American story, that how somebody who came from Filipino roots, Filipino stewards, winds up being physician of the President of the United States. And I think in a lot of ways, that's the amazing part of this story.
It sure is. I wonder how often you got, you're the doctor?
Yeah.
Quite a few times off
just
it.
Smile. Huh? You teach him.
Right. Oh, you were just wonderful. Thank you, Dr.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure to have you on. Our guest, Dr. Connie Mariano, and the book is The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents, a memoir. It has been published just recently by St. Martin's Press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for your calls. Until tomorrow.